This is The Guardian.
Whether you know your kimchi from your kefir or it's your first time boiling an egg, you'll be able to make delicious meals easily with The Guardian's new Feast app. Discover vibrant vegan dishes with me, Mira Soda, hearty comfort foods with Nigel Slater, bold flavours with Yotam Ottolenghi, and many more tasty offerings from expert Guardian cooks. Experience the ultimate cooking app, Feast, today. Download now and enjoy a 14-day free trial. Terms and conditions apply.
We've had all the pomp, ceremony and archaic nonsense that you'd expect from a state opening of Parliament.
Black Rock!
But the new government wanted this occasion to be about hope and ambition, and among lots of other stuff, the renationalisation of the railways, a British energy bill and housing reform.
My ministers will get Britain building, including through planning reform, as they seek to accelerate the delivery of high-quality infrastructure and housing.
Whether any of this can make a difference to our lives probably depends on big questions about the new Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, and public spending. Meanwhile, with the world looking ever more unstable and dangerous, the two obvious words here are Donald and Trump, will the government's air of optimism soon look increasingly fragile? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. Joining me today are Pippa Crerar, The Guardian's political editor, and Kieran Stacey, our political correspondent. And let's not forget, they're also the hosts of the Politics Weekly Westminster podcast every Monday. Good afternoon to you both.
Hello.
Hey, John.
Hi. Right, let's talk about the King's speech and everything that followed on from it. Last time we had a speech from the monarch, the Labour Party was in power. That was in 2009, when Gordon Brown was the Prime Minister. In a statement overnight, Keir Starmer, the new Prime Minister, in case anyone hasn't noticed, said he wanted to, quote, take the brakes off Britain, unquote, and talked about growth, what a surprise, and creating wealth for people. Reform and renationalisation of so-called infrastructure were both big parts of the speech. So let's start there. Renationalisation of the railways has been kicking around politics for years and years and years. People mutter it under their breath when they have another hideous experience on the railways. And there it is. Albeit gradually. And then the other big move on public transport was the promised restoration of local control of buses, or what some people call re-regulation, along the lines that Andy Burnham has done in Greater Manchester, and the lifting of the ban on publicly owned buses. Neither, obviously, is going to be a quick solution to our massive transport problems, but this is big political stuff, and it's safe to say they'll be popular. A lot is read into public transport politically on the part of this new government, isn't it?
Yeah, do you know what? It's surprising in a couple of ways, John. Not only that, you know, that's such a big part of the King's speech, but we received a briefing overnight from the government about what was going to be in the King's speech. And top of that briefing, the thing they wanted to flag up most of all was renationalisation of the railways. And I say it's surprising for a couple of reasons. One is it doesn't quite fit the growth narrative. It's not really a growth measure. You could argue maybe that if you make the railways better, you'll encourage people to travel around the country and you'll boost economic activity. But it doesn't really fit the narrative. And second of all,
are you sure?
Well, I don't.
I often think when I'm stuck on yet another train somewhere outside Reading that pulls into a siding for 40 minutes on the way into London, if not more, how much output is being lost by this happening so often? It is a growth issue.
I'm not saying public transport is not a growth issue, but I don't know that renationalisation of the railways is necessarily being billed as part of the government's growth plans. It's much more a kind of straightforward, you know, return to competence. You know, try and get things on an even keel again. Let's be honest. You want to boost growth through the railways, you might think about doing HS2, and they're not going to do that. At least they have no active plans to do so. But the other thing is, we were talking before the election, maybe a little while before the election, for a while, about the idea that this whole idea might actually get scrapped. And at times, it looked like Louise Hague's job as then Shadow Transport Secretary might be at risk. This was seen by some in the Labour Party, I think, as a bit of a relic from old Labour, from Corbyn-era Labour. And were they really going to go into an election promising a massive renationalisation scheme? Well, they did, and they're so proud of it, they put it in the middle of their King's speech today. So, you know, that's been a great survivor.
It's not just that they put it in the middle of the King's speech, of course. What I was at a Downing Street briefing afterwards when they were sort of setting out what we should expect over the coming year of legislation. And they made it clear that they're going to publish three bills tomorrow that we'll see immediately the first reading of. And one of those bills was renationalisation of the railway. Now, when you look at the other two that they're doing, one was their, it's much more political, their OBR economic responsibility bill, which is basically off the back of Liz Truss failing to conduct an OBR review ahead of her disastrous mini budget. The government has said that they're going to bring in a bill which means that they will, that the OBR will have to do an independent assessment of any tax or spending changes, major tax or spending changes. The idea being that she was, you know, to contrast her, as they see it, incredible irresponsibility with their responsibility with the economy. That is what, another one that's going to be published tomorrow, as is the Holocaust Memorial Bill about building a new education centre right next to Parliament. So those three bills are the ones that they're, you know, they're sort of getting stuck into absolutely immediately, which I think is quite telling about how, and unexpected, I agree with Kieran, about how, you know, what they're prioritising, because they've said throughout it's about fixing the foundations of the country, it's about growth, economic growth to all parts of the country. So things like housing and planning and devolution and energy and all those sorts of things you might expect. Yet they're putting the emphasis, they're underlying in sort of red pen, the fact that they're going ahead with the passenger railway services, public ownership in brackets bill.
Can I give you one snippet, John, that you'll quite like as a regular train user? In what we're told about that renationalisation bill is one little detail that they're also looking at how to introduce digital ticketing across the rail network, which essentially would mean you can touch in and touch out on trains, probably not to go long distance, but at least regionally, to get on and off trains across the country. That'd be quite a nice
I'm all in favour of it. Buses is important, but I'll just touch on that briefly. Buses are the most used form of public transport, let's not forget. So I understand, and you, why you just said what you said, and the government is in the position that it's in about railway renationalisation. It's interesting. It's one of those policies that seems to me runs between someone who might have voted Reform, who they want to vote Labour again, and then a left-wing person who might have voted Green and they want to vote Labour again. Renationalisation of the railways is one of those things that tie those two together. But the importance of buses and improving bus transport can't be overstated. Right, let's move on to so-called infrastructure, planning reform. Local councils will have to adopt mandatory housing targets, we are told. The government also wants local authorities to work together to identify infrastructure needs in an attempt to stop individual councils blocking plans. And there's a lot of talk about pushing through planning consent for things like power stations. This could get very, very bumpy. This might turn out to be very interesting in a way that the government won't like, right? In the sense that there's so many controversies everywhere about housing and infrastructure and planning permission. And the idea of central government, albeit with good intentions, railroading this stuff through, it's going to make life quite difficult, one would imagine.
Yeah, and let me give you one more, John, as well, which is they're going to make it easier for public bodies to issue compulsory purchase orders. They're going to do that by basically making sure that whoever owns that land can't charge what's called hope value, which is the kind of expected value of that land once it's been built on. They basically will reduce the price of issuing a compulsory purchase order massively by doing that. Now, can you imagine you're a rural landowner? You're going to be absolutely furious about that. I picked up a bit of cynicism about how much of an effect these planning changes will make. But let's not forget there was a reason why the Tories dropped those mandatory housing targets for local authorities. They were immensely controversial in lots of areas, and lots of areas that Labour's just won. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think there's going to be a fight coming across large parts of England on this stuff.
It's interesting. I'm going to pick up my local democracy reporter in Somerset where I live, Daniel Mumby, who does tireless work. This stuff is live. It happens all the time. So Wincanton, you might have heard, is a town in Somerset where there's a race course. There's a controversy there at the moment about 650 new homes because people are questioning the fact that there won't be a new doctor's surgery, right, along with the homes. You get this constant sense at the moment that when new housing developments go up, the roads can't take it, there aren't enough new schools, there aren't enough new places at doctor surgeries, etc., etc. And this government, it seems, says, well, if it comes to it, we'll sideline those concerns and we'll push this stuff through. So politically, in Labour-held constituencies as well, right, that's the important point, a lot of this may well prove to be very controversial.
That's the point when you've won a 170-seat majority and you've won in parts of the country where you don't normally win. You've suddenly got a lot of constituents, a lot of Labour voters, who might have liked the party's message of change, but now are starting to realise that some of the changes that you're implementing are going to affect them as well.
Yeah, and when you listen to government on this, it's really interesting because they're saying the right things about supporting infrastructure, making sure that there's local roads in place and transport and schools, and as you mentioned, doctor surgeries. to support these new homes. And they're sort of suggesting that some of the reporting overnight about local people getting less of a say is not actually correct. They say that they will get more of a say through the local planning process when it comes to where some of the homes might be built. But it is clear that they do intend to press on and to build those homes. And ultimately, you know, this is going to be one of what Labour's going to quickly find, I think, is that it's all very well coming up with the right rhetoric and the right messaging. But when it hits headfirst into reality, which inevitably does when you're governing at every level, things can get a bit more problematic. So it's going to be interesting to see that if this is, as we think, sort of the core of this King's speech, the core of the legislative programme designed to boost growth across the country, they're really going to have to stick with it. And that means some really difficult fights ahead.
It's still a bit unclear, isn't it? Or very unclear. What kind of housing, this much talked up 1.5 million new houses, how that's going to fall tenure-wise, right? And you regularly hear a lot of people asking questions about how much of it is or isn't going to be social housing. We still don't know, do we?
No, and I think the expectation is they prefer to talk about affordable housing rather than, and social housing is sort of, you know, part of that. But their expectation is that this is primarily funded by the private sector. And you know, the affordable housing element of it is about as much as they can get out of the private sector, and whether they can sort of push them to do more. But you know, we've all seen, thanks to Right to Buy, the numbers of council housing stock depleting, dramatically in recent times, and it hasn't been replaced. And you know, housing waiting lists, as we all know from our local areas, are really long. So, you know, I think there will be a lot of pressure, as with everything, frankly, that they set out today, for more detail. And we'll be pushing them for
more. Also, John, you talk about tenure, which is quite interesting, because another thing that's in there is the leasehold reform bill. And this was promised by the previous government, and Labour's now picked it up and said, hey, look, we will do our best to effectively, but not quite entirely, get rid of the whole system of leasehold. The thing is, that's a draft bill, which suggests that there are only four draft bills in this entire package of 40 bills. And by it being a draft bill suggests it's not a priority. And in fact, may never happen. Draft bills often don't. Okay. Now, if that bill doesn't happen and you have a load of new house building basically being done by the private sector, what's to stop there being loads of those being leasehold? Like there could well be a lot more leasehold flats go up across the country, even though this government has promised to get rid of that system. It's kind of an interesting wrinkle.
Yeah, we can sense more potential controversy coming down the track here, which is interesting. English devolution deserves a mention. The Metro Mayor model, it seems, will be extended to anywhere that would like it. And then another interesting point for me, one of the ministers I think to really watch is going to be Bridget Phillips and the new Education Secretary. The government has promised in the King's Speech a children's wellbeing bill, which will include the free breakfast clubs that were talked about a lot during the election campaign. It's going to push through a duty on councils to keep a register of children not in school, and increase local powers on school admissions with a duty on schools to cooperate on special needs inclusion. Special needs education, quite strikingly, was mentioned by Keir Starmer when he talked about Tory failure in his speech today. So again, that stuff doesn't get picked up very much, but I thought that was significant hearing that. But let's talk about the very, very big picture. Pippa, you mentioned a moment ago the so-called anti-Liz Truss bill on spending rules. It's a legislate to ensure that all significant tax and spending changes are subject to an independent assessment by the Office for Budget Responsibility. Liz Truss herself, I don't know whether she's still at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee or whether she's come home, wherever home is now, certainly not in Norfolk, but she's responded on Twitter saying this will lead to economic stagnation. Well, she would know. Anyway, there is a huge set of questions hanging over this, isn't there? Which is just about tax and spend, about public spending, which we haven't heard anything about yet, really, apart from feints and nudges and winks, because we're going to have to wait till the autumn. But that really is the deciding thing, isn't it? We're not going to get a full picture of what this government's all about until then.
No, that's it. I mean, the key moment will be when Rachel Reeves stands up for the first time, delivers her first budget, potentially first spending review this autumn, when they will have already pressed the button on the OBR projections. That obviously then takes 10 weeks before budget happens. And they will have had a proper chance to, as they put it, lift up the bonnet and take a look at the books of various government departments. And, you know,
can I just ask you, Pippa, isn't that a load of rubbish, this idea that they have to wait until they get into power and then they suddenly find out the horror of the public?
They know
finance.
Already. And actually, it was quite interesting in the last few weeks of the campaign. We were reporting that Labour had this strategy that they were going to sort of come into power, say that things were much worse than they'd anticipated, the so-called, you know, doctor's mandate, that they would have to take dramatic action to try and, you know, get the economy back on track, whether that included maybe wealth taxes or even more cuts or, you know, borrowing for things that they'd previously said that they wouldn't borrow for. And Rachel Reeves was pushed on this by us and others ahead of the election and basically conceded that actually they already knew that things were pretty bad. And I thought it was quite striking today in the King's speech that in his list of areas where things were worse than they'd anticipated coming into power, Keir Starmer didn't mention the economy because obviously we already know how bad it is. He mentioned instead, you know, the rivers and the sea and prisons and council funding. So it will be a moment where they will attempt, I think, politically, it would be useful for them to be able to turn around and say, look, we've not only inherited a mess, it's worse of a mess than we thought. And that means we're going to have to take some quite tough action. But the bottom line
Which means what? Now, let me ask you this, because there's stuff kicking around already about rumours that Rachel Reeves, come the autumn, will say that taxes need putting up. Are you hearing those?
So this has been sort of under discussion for, you know, weeks now, really. It's not just since they came into power. And as you will remember, they ruled out tax rises on working people, as they put it. So national insurance, personal income tax and VAT. They also said that they wouldn't put up corporation tax on businesses. But there's a whole load of other levers that she can pull. They were very circumspect when it came to talking about capital gains tax, for example, other potential wealth taxes, closing loopholes, that sort of thing, where they could raise, you know, 10 billion quid, more maybe, if they so needed. And we didn't have them ruling those out, you know, going into the election. So we may well see that. But I think the backdrop to all of this is important to be remembered, that there is this what was accused, they were accused by economists of a conspiracy of silence, not just Labour, but the Tory party as well, about the state of the economy and the fact that there was under the government, the former government spending plans, there was a £20 billion black hole in their sums that would need to be filled. And, you know, the reasoning would be if the Conservatives had won the election, that that would mean more cuts, another round of austerity. Labour hasn't said what it would do about that. So, you know, unless they end up with finding, you know, spare 20 billion quid down the back of the sofa, which is not to be ruled out, they have their ways and means, then, you know, I think they're going to have to be honest with us finally, come the autumn, come the budget, about the state of the economy and crucially what they're going to do about it.
Massive, massive questions. Right, just to end this segment, let me ask you this, like a pub quiz question, both of you. What wasn't in the King's speech that you might have expected to be in it?
So the things I'd say would be Vote 16 and the retirement age of the House of Lords, both of which we're told will happen at some point, but neither is their immediate priority and neither needs to happen right now.
A couple of things that I think were talked about, but not really that. I mean, I mentioned the leasehold thing, which is kind of interesting that it was a draft bill rather than a proper bill. The other thing I think that came up in the King's speech itself, but then I didn't see in the package of measures, was an AI bill. So there's been a lot of talk about Labour. And in fact, I think Rishi Sunak mentioned it today. Labour's going to put in strict new rules for AI. I didn't see any.
No, and we should also quickly mention as well, social care. There was no legislation to set up a national care service. No doubt we're going to have loads of consultation for us. They said there's no quick, Downing Street said there's no quick legislative fix to this one. And actually, there is, under the workers' rights legislation, fair pay deals for care sector workers, which they say is important to dealing with the recruitment and retention and training crisis in social care, and that is, you know, a pressing problem that they can do something about now.
Right, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we will talk about the current mood in the government and beyond that appearance of optimism and freshness and what they might be worried about.
Hello everyone, it's me, Shantae, here from the Guardian's Pop Culture Podcast. I just wanted to let you know that on this week's episode, I'm going to be interviewing Ratman, the creator of Supercell, which is currently Netflix's number one show in the world. So if you're a fan of this show and you want to hear how the superhero genre has been shaken up, then go and listen to us wherever you get your podcasts and have a glorious day.
Whether you know your kimchi from your kefir or it's your first time boiling an egg, you'll be able to make delicious meals easily with The Guardian's new Feast app. Discover vibrant vegan dishes with me, Mira Soda, hearty comfort foods with Nigel Slater, bold flavours with Yotam Ottolenghi, and many more tasty offerings from expert Guardian cooks. Experience the ultimate cooking app, Feast, today. Download now and enjoy a 14-day free trial. Terms and conditions apply.
Thank you.
Welcome back. There is an obvious tension in the political air at the moment, it seems to me. We've got this very excited, fast-paced new government and a lot of optimism swirling around. When at the same time, every time I look at my phone or switch on the radio or watch the TV, the biggest stories in the news are unsettling and scary. I am talking in the context of the last few days, obviously, about the attempted assassination of Donald Trump, how it's increased his chances of becoming president again, and really thrown it to even sharper relief what a terrible mess the Democratic Party in the States appears to be in. And meanwhile, as we know, populists are making trouble all over Europe. I was very struck by what Starmer said in the Commons today. He went very big on the idea that his government has to offer a clear alternative to that kind of politics, setting the bar very, very high. Do you think, either of you, that the Labour Party is feeling a certain dread about how incongruous all this optimism and sort of supposed efficiency and we're getting on with it is in the middle of this very troubling picture on a sort of global scale?
I think they'll take it where they can get it, frankly. I mean, look, we've had a pretty bleak backdrop to our politics over the last few years, from the pandemic to the war in Ukraine, the cost of living crisis, Tory sort of, you know, chaos and infighting. And I think, you know, there is a moment where actually we can allow ourselves a little bit of hope. And we should. A new government's coming in. There's an opportunity for change. They haven't yet screwed it up. I mean, that might come down the line. But, you know, they're making big promises on pretty radical reform, actually, that could change the country quite dramatically. I think it's both important to be able to kind of feel that hope, but also temper it with realism that things are pretty hard, that it will take them. I mean, we've talked already about planning and changes there, but this is across the board. They may struggle to get some of their reforms through, both with public opposition and indeed internal opposition, despite their majority. And I think they know that, but I think they're just enjoying this moment. And, you know, I was away with Keir Starmer on that trip to Washington last week. And we talked a little bit about whether Britain could be a sort of a beacon of hope for progressive governments, for progressive parties across the world, when you look what's happening in the States, as you mentioned, John, but also closer to home, over the channel in France, Poland, Germany, Italy, and the rise of populism there. And Starmer said yes, basically, that he thought that it was, there was an onus, there was responsibility on his government, not just domestically to show people that they can have faith in politics, but also to show internationally that his type of politics can work. And the key to that is delivering meaningful change, not over-promising, delivering what you say you're going to do, and actually making a sort of like a tangible difference to people's lives, sometimes in quite small ways. And, you know, yes, there's big longer-term changes, nationalisation, the railways and devolution and things like that. But there's also stuff in the speech, you know, like the vaping stuff, things about banning people on noisy motorbikes, antisocial behaviour, football governance, which you can just imagine people sitting talking about down the pub, which might be easier to achieve, but will hopefully show them, the government thinks, that small steps can also be taken to make a difference.
Little things mean a lot. Kieran, as well as sort of putting himself forward, or his government forward, as the alternative to this rampant populism all over the world, which I thought was quite daring. It takes quite a lot of chutzpah to do that. He also set quite high expectations in another way, right? He talked about no more political gimmicks, no more wedge issues. It's all about the national interest now, not party interest. Again, could be perceived as quite risky. I remember Tony Blair saying this, and then the first sniff of anything questionable or allegedly corrupt about his government, and he was asked the question, well, this isn't what you said a year ago, right? Those of us who are old enough remember that. Do you think that's quite sort of bold on Starmer's part?
I was really interested in that bit of the speech. I mean, I think that it's, you know, in terms of the ethics stuff, those scandals are going to, he knows, those scandals are going to affect his government, and a lot will just depend on how he responds to them. And I'm sure, you know, in Keir Starmer's head, he's got a plan for dealing with those scandals when they come about during this next parliament. The thing I was slightly more interested in, actually, was his mention of wedge issues and gimmicks, because, you know, when you are in government, it's very tempting, I think, to reach for the wedge issues. And as he said, it was quite funny, where I was seated in the Commons, I had a very direct view of Rishi Sunak, and next to him, Oliver Dowden, who I think is widely regarded as one of the principal users of wedge issues, very, very political man, but kind of in the model of George Osborne. George Osborne used to use this stuff all the time. Now, the thing is about gimmicks and wedge issues, yeah, you can kind of stand there and look very prime ministerial by denouncing them, but the point is they're actually quite politically effective. And, you know, it's not necessarily a great idea to set yourself up from the start of your government as never trying to, you know, decide issues on which you can put the opposition on one side and yourself on the other.
Arguably he's already done it. I mean, I agree wholeheartedly with imposing VAT on private school fees, but viewed from a certain perspective, that's a proper wedge issue, right?
There you go. Yeah, exactly. Labour will choose issues to try and embarrass the Tories over, and not just the big stuff like
that. Can I just say as well that I laughed out loud to hear the King, an alumnus of Gordonstoun, who sent his kids to Eton, having to read that bit of the King's speech out.
You've clipped that to replay over and over again, haven't you, John?
I thought that was a lovely moment. It's just the intrusion of a little bit of class war into the King's speech. You don't get much. Although, having said that, the term working class is back in fashion, isn't it? Everyone in this government uses it.
Yeah, from day one. I remember, I think Keir Starmer used it straight after the election, didn't he? He talked about working class, and just in case we thought that was a slip, then other members of his government, I think Rachel Reeves maybe did as well.
Yeah, that's true.
It was really striking to me, because gone now, apparently, is the term hardworking families. We're back into a kind of politics that acknowledges that class exists and maybe wants to do something about it. It was very striking reversal of Blairite terminology.
And very proudly as well, coming out and saying, you know, the day that the cabinet was selected, so the day after the election, saying that, you know, all but two members of the cabinet went to this local state schools. You know, 3/4 of us came from, they would say, from working class backgrounds, you know, really sort of out and proud about it as well.
Yeah, amazing. In contrast to the Etonian domination of Tory politics up to now, it is worth noting that there is a school that two cabinet ministers went to in the case of this new government, and it's Parswood School, a state comprehensive in South Manchester. I think that's quite a striking difference. Right, quick mention of the fact that politics, in all its sort of grinding difficulty, has reared its head somewhat for this new government, in the sense that Vaughan Gething, the former First Minister of Wales, resigned this week. There's a lot of talk about the Labour Party having been in power in Wales for 23 years, and the sense that there is a slight sense of rot and decay about the Labour power in Wales. And that's ironic and interesting in the sense that talk has erupted just as this new government takes over in Westminster. I think that's worth mentioning. But let me just end with some brief stuff about problems and controversies that the government is already facing as far as Westminster politics is concerned. Keir Starmer has done something quite interesting today. He has set up a child poverty task force, among heavy hints that it might deal with one of the things that is already snapping at the heels of this government: the possible lifting of the 2-child limit on child benefit, imposed arguably as one of those wedge issues by George Osborne. That's an interesting development, isn't it? That noise about the 2-child limit is becoming sort of unavoidable as far as Keir Starmer's concerned.
Yeah, it was really interesting. In the speeches, the King's speeches, so Rishi Sunak stood up, then Keir Starmer stood up. Keir Starmer took an intervention, quite unusually for it, not totally unprecedented, but quite unusual for a King's speech. Keir Starmer took an intervention from a backbencher called Sarah Owen, a Labour MP, who specifically asked him, presumably a question planted by the whips, apologies to her if that's not the case, but asked him about child poverty strategy. And it gave him the opportunity to say that he'd set up this task force today, because it is the single issue which, if you ask any backbencher you bump into in Westminster, is the single issue that they say that they want the government to get a grip of, that they haven't already pledged to do. And I think what the pushback has always been from the government, from the shadow cabinet as was in the cabinet now, is that they could potentially lift the limit if the money was there, but then you're stuck with the same system. And actually, the system needs much more fundamental reform, you know, maybe of the type, different but of the scale of Ian Duncan Smith bringing in universal credit, to make it sort of fit for purpose and to address some of the challenges that families face now. So I think politically still, despite the pressure, they're going to resist lifting the limit. But they clearly recognise the need, not just internally within the Labour Party, but also across the country, to tackle the issue of child poverty and make absolutely clear to people that they regard it as a key priority.
I don't think Starmer's going to be able to hold those backbenchers at bay for very long. You know, there's only so many commissions, inquiries, consultations you can launch before people are going to turn around and say, I'm sorry, you actually need to do something about this. But let me just, on that issue, but turning to slightly lower politics, it was quite funny. I was in the chamber watching when Sarah Owen stood up, and I thought, is that a question planted by the whips? Is it not? I agree with you, Pippa, I think it was. But what it also meant was every Tory MP then realised that once the precedent had been set for an intervention on Keir Starmer, they all started standing up. And he felt that having taken one from his own side, he couldn't refuse. So he was constantly interrupted during what is normally, you know, a fairly prosaic occasion when people don't interrupt and it's supposed to be quite, you know, consensual across the chamber. You're constantly interrupted by Tory MPs complaining about everything his government was doing. So I don't know if he realised that would be the consequence of trying to do that with Sarah Owen, but it certainly was.
Yeah, I thought that served his purpose, though, in two ways, really. It sort of highlighted for anyone watching how awful a lot of Tory MPs are, at the same time as it underlined this idea that Keir Starmer was now moving beyond partisan politics and was prepared to listen to different points of view.
Yeah, or maybe, although he was punching back pretty heavily. So he was trying to be non-partisan, you know, maybe that wasn't the way to do it. You know, by the end, it felt more like a session of PMQs.
More knockabout, definitely.
Well, we'll return to normal sessions of PMQs in due course. I'm quite looking forward to those. In the meantime, it only falls to me to say thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you out there for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. As I always say, if you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK, wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Eva Krisiak. The music is by Axel Cacoutier. And the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.
Whether you know your kimchi from your kefir or it's your first time boiling an egg, you'll be able to make delicious meals easily with The Guardian's new Feast app. Discover vibrant vegan dishes with me, Mira Soda, hearty comfort foods with Nigel Slater, bold flavours with Yotam Ottolenghi, and many more tasty offerings from expert Guardian cooks. Experience the ultimate cooking app, Feast, today. Download now and enjoy a 14-day free trial. Terms and conditions apply.